It's noon on Wednesday, November 19th. Mark DeGroft with you in the reading of the Arizona Daily Star. From Phoenix, the board overseeing the state agency that is charged with finding new water supplies for Arizona is poised to approve as many as 5 imported water proposals for startup funding from taxpayers this week, but at least one potential project reignites decades of controversy. A conservation group and an Indian tribe warned the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority Committee, screening the projects behind closed doors last week, that EPCOR's apparent proposal is fraught with risk and can't deliver the stable water supply that Arizona needs. Details of the 5 projects, 2 involving desalinization plants and others relying on wastewater treatment, surface water, and unidentified third source, remain secret until the full board of the agency known as WIFA or WIFA meets today, Wednesday. But the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe and the National Parks Conservation Association said it's pretty clear that EPCOR plans to rely on a controversial pumping project in the remote southeastern California desert that has been fraught by environmentalists for decades. The conservation group contends that EPCOR and the developer of the California Desert Project, Cadeus Incorporated, are relying on ignorance of officials here in about the Arizona project, which has faced vociferous opposition in California, to get some of the nearly $400 million in Arizona tax dollars that WIFA has to give away to develop plans to import the water. Canadian water provider EPCOR, which operates municipal water systems in several Arizona communities, most notably in the Santan Valley on the southeastern edge of Metro Phoenix, signed a memorandum of understanding with Cadiz on August 1st. WIFA has not made public any of the plans that it is considering, which may also be controversial, and EPCOR, owned by the city of Edmonton in the Canadian province of Alberta, has made no public announcement of the deal to import water into Arizona. But the reason there are details of this plan is that Cadiz is a publicly traded company that enabled Capital Media Services to access a notice it had on file with security regulators about its memo of understanding with EPCOR. The deal, if finalized, gives EPCOR exclusive rights to market 25,000-acre square feet of Arizona annually from the project, located in a remote section of the California desert about 60 miles west of Parker. It also requires it to finance and build a section of pipeline to deliver that water. The Cadiz project, which has been named the Mojave Groundwater Bank, relies on ancient groundwater located under an expansive desert valley. Cadiz plans to pump 50,000 acre-feet per year for 50 years from the project and has tried for decades to get the needed approvals to sell the water to Southern California water providers. An acre-foot is about 326,000 gallons, enough water to cover an acre of land 1 foot deep and typically enough to supply 3 homes for a year. Cadiz said it's a goal to sustainably deliver clean, affordable water to people who need it. But the company's proposal has been fought for 30 years by California politicians, conservation and environmental groups, and federal agencies, at least when Democrats controlled them. And it so far has been not delivered any water. Its project has passed a series of environmental reviews, but California in 2019 passed a law requiring a state agency to add another layer of approvals. Because its pipelines would cross federal land, it also needs federal agency approval. The first Trump administration greenlighted the proposal, but a federal judge blocked its approval of a pipeline across federal lands. The Biden administration then pulled the federal approvals, but the company this year signed an agreement with the United States Interior Department to support development of its groundwater bank. The tribe and conservation group say that pumping will imperil springs that provide the only water within 1,000 square miles and nourish wildlife, including bighorn sheep. And they say that once the water is gone, the vast desert region won't be able to support people either. Nir Desai, the regional director for National Parks Conservation Association, testified to the WEFA board panel last week. He said in an interview that his group and the tribe are trying to ensure WEFA knows about the controversial background of the pumping proposal and its opposition from California politicians, including Governor Gavin Newsom and the state's two U.S. senators. It's been around for 40 years and it doesn't have a shovel in the ground because it would be a complete disaster, Desai said about the Cadiz proposal. From Lagari, Nigeria, the villagers in northwestern Nigeria were setting in for church service when motorcycle riding gunmen invaded, shooting at random and seizing at least 62 people, including the pastor and several children. They were marched into the nearby bush and then forced to walk for 2 days to a forest hideout. There, they said, they were held for nearly a month while relatives and other villagers sold anything that they could, including farmland, livestock, and motorcycles, to raise the ransom demanded for their release. They got little food and sleep, were told to renounce Christianity, and saw two fellow hostages killed. Four of the villagers who were eventually free told the Associated Press in interviews at their church in the Lagari community in Nigeria's Kaduna State. I told my people, even if they see my dead body, they should not deny Jesus and they should remain strong, said the Reverend Micah Boulos, who is the resident pastor of Kana Baptist Church. Since the attack last November, the community has experienced more violence, like much of the conflict-battered north. On Monday, gunmen abducted 25 schoolgirls and killed at least one staff member in a boarding school in Kebbi, another northwestern state. In Lagari, villagers say nearly every household has seen a relative, a friend, or a neighbor killed or abducted. As part of the long-standing security crisis in Nigeria, a place now singled out by U.S. President Trump for the killing of Christians by Islamic radicals. From Charlotte, North Carolina, federal immigration authorities will expand their enforcement action in North Carolina to Raleigh as soon as Tuesday, the mayor of the state's capital city said, while Customs and Border Protection agents continue operating in Charlotte following a weekend that saw arrests of more than 130 people in that city. Mayor Janet Colwell said on Monday she didn't know how large the operation would be or how long agents would be present. Immigration authorities haven't spoken about it. The Democrats said in a statement that crime was lower in Raleigh this year compared to last and that public safety was a priority for her and the city council. I ask Raleigh to remember our values and maintain peace and respect through any upcoming challenges, Colwell said in a statement. The U.S. immigration agents arrested more than 130 people over the weekend in a sweep through Charlotte, North Carolina's largest city, federal officials said on Monday. From Kyiv, Ukraine, before the revelation of a multi-million-dollar embezzlement and kickback scandal involving Ukraine's state nuclear energy company brought his name to the forefront, Tymur Mindish was a shadowy presence, navigating deals and moving behind the scenes with unseen influence known to many yet rarely spoken about. Mindish was linked to growing fears over his expanding influence within the country's lucrative industries, his access facilitated by his ties to President Volodymyr Zelensky. The two were once business partners, and Mindich's influence has expanded under Zelensky's tenure. The full extent of that influence was exposed this week when Ukraine's anti-corruption watchdogs released the findings of a 15-month investigation into a $100 million embezzlement scheme involving top officials and Ukraine's state nuclear power company, accusing Mindich of being the mastermind behind the plot. Mindich has fled the country with any criminal proceedings against him likely to be carried out in absentia. Two top government ministers have resigned. Ukrainian officials, experts, and activists contend Mindich's rise to power is closely tied to his privileged relationship with the president and Zelensky's inner circle. The investigation does not implicate Zelensky himself, and he has openly supported the work of anti-corruption agencies while sanctioning Mindich once its findings were revealed. Writing on X on Saturday, the president said the leadership of state-owned energy companies will be renewed and their finances audited. What we are hearing only as rumors now has some evidence, said activist Tetyana Svishuk in Ukraine's Anti-Corruption Action Center. For a long time, we have heard that Timur Mindich is a shadow controller of the energy sector. Until Zelensky's presidency, Mindich, who's 46 years old, was just one among many wealthy Ukrainian entertainment industry entrepreneurs. Mindich was co-owner of Zelensky's production company, Kvartal 95, named for the comedy troupe that helped catapult the Ukrainian president to fame as a comedian before he entered politics. Zelensky transferred his stake in the company to his partners after he was elected. Despite expanding his business portfolio since Zelensky's election, Mindich maintained ties to the entertainment world. Until the corruption probe was exposed this week, he was a producer of the comedy show Stadium Family on YouTube. In light of the scandal and his tarnished reputation, the show's owner shut it down this week. He's also a relative of Leonid Mindich, who was arrested by Ukraine's anti-corruption authorities in June while he was trying to flee the country, according to local reports. He was charged with embezzling $16 million from an electric power company. Zelensky and Mindich's close friendship is documented. The president used Mindich's armored car during the final stretch of his presidential campaign in 2019. In January of 2021, Zelensky celebrated his birthday in Mindich's apartment during COVID. They too own apartments in the same building. And after Zelensky's 2019 presidential win, Mindich's political ties grew. He was the closest business associate of Ukrainian oligarch Ihor Kolomansky, who backed Zelensky's presidential campaign. Zelensky later cut ties with the billionaire, and in 2023, Kolomansky was arrested by Ukrainian security forces on fraud and money laundering charges. Businesses once associated with Kolomansky began claiming that Mindich was now their beneficiary. Gradually, in 3 years, he became not an oligarch, but a known business owner with an interest in a lot of businesses, said Svechuk, the anti-corruption activist. Moving on to news from the Tucson region section of this morning's Star. Four elementary schools in the Amphitheater Unified School District could be closed next year, the district superintendent said in a notice to staff and families on Monday evening. Superintendent Tom Jaeger cited dropping enrollment as the reason he will recommend that the district governing board move to close the schools. And those schools are Copper Creek Elementary at 11620 North Copper Spring Trail, Donaldson Elementary School at 2040 West Omar Drive, Nash Elementary School at 515 West Kelso Street, and Holloway Elementary School at 3500 North Cherry Avenue. Jaeger said in the email that students from Copper Creek would go to either Painted Sky at 12620 North Woodburn Avenue or Harrelson at 826 West Chapala Drive elementary schools. Students at Donaldson would go to Mesa Verde at 1661 West Sage Street. Students at Holloway would go to Rio Vista Elementary at 1351 East Limberlost Drive. And students from Nash will go to either Keeling at 2837 North Los Altos or Walker at 1750 West Roller Coaster Road Elementary Schools. These recommendations would weigh heavily on my heart, as I know they do on yours. And yet, despite these challenges, Amphitheater remains strong, Jaeger said in the email. Today, we will take thoughtful and decisive actions that protect what matters most, exceptional teaching, thriving school communities, and the well-being of every student, Jaeger warned parents and staff last month that the closures are likely. He cited a sudden and steep decline in student involvement, resulting in several million dollars of lost funding. Three community meetings will be held about the planned closures. They are each set to begin at 6:30 p.m. on the following dates and locations. First, on Wednesday, November 19th, that's today, at Ironwood Ridge High School. That meeting will be about the proposed Copper Creek, Painted Sky, and Harrelson consolidation. Tomorrow, November 20th, at Amphitheater High School, at That meeting will be held about the consolidation of Nash, Walker, and Keeling, as well as the consolidation of Holloway and Rio Vista. And Friday's meeting on November 21st at the Canyon del Oro High School, that meeting will be about the Donaldson and Mesa Verde schools. Yeager said he will present the plan to AmpFi's governing board when they meet on December 9th. Action could be taken on the plan as early as January. An amphitheater currently has 22 schools. From Phoenix, 9-year-old Faith Todd was Wolf-Hirschhorn syndrome, epilepsy, and autism, conditions that put her at constant risk of seizures, choking, and falls without close supervision. Her mother, Amber Todd, a former EMT who paused her career to care for Faith full-time, has intervened and saved her daughter's life more times than she can count. The family lives in rural Greenlee County and is among thousands across Arizona that rely on state funding through the Division of Developmental Disabilities to care for their loved ones. That support is now uncertain as the division revises eligibility following a sharp increase in program spending. DDD spent $77 million on attendant care and rehabilitation services in 2019. In just 5 years, that amount grew to $614 million, according to recent reports. During a town hall in late September, DDD Assistant Director Zane Garcia Ramadan told attendees that the spending was unsustainable. DDD released the statement, explaining the agency is currently supporting more people and providing more services than ever before. This kind of growth does not align with budgetary increases, which places strain on the delivery system. Faith sat next to Todd, intermittently resting her head on her mom's arm, as Todd told Cronkite News what it would mean for them to lose access to the funding they receive to keep Faith safe and comfortable in her own home. Families like mine are facing housing instability, food instability, mental crisis, health crises over this. It's a very, very scary time, Todd said. DDD rolled out new assessments for attendant care and rehabilitation services on October 1st, intended to reduce a drastic increase in spending by placing stricter guidelines on how many billable hours of in-home care are approved for families. Attendant care hours cover in-home supports, transferring, supervision, and physical care for things like bathing and feeding. Habitation is a goal-based service that focuses on teaching a child the skills they need to become as independent as possible, according to Brandy Kuhn, who has a child with developmental disabilities and is the president of Raising Voices Coalition, an organization that advocates for developmental disability policy. The attended care and rehabilitation program allows parents to become full-time caregivers for their children with disabilities, Kuhn said. Billable hours are approved based on individual assessments that are set by DDD and carried out by a quarterly support coordinator. The new assessment tool failed to consider individual diagnoses and cases where children relying on extraordinary round-the-clock care requiring more hours. Instead, DDD rolled out rigid, age-based evaluation. From Phoenix, a Republican lawmaker who wants to be the state's chief elections officer wants Arizona voters to have to provide documented proof of citizenship in order to vote in federal elections, despite a federal appellate court ruling voiding a similar law. In the new proposal, Representative Alexander Cullinan of Scottsdale seeks to insert a provision in the Arizona Constitution to say that only citizens can register and vote in any public election in Arizona. And it spells out that the early ballots are available only to those who have provided citizenship proof. But there's more. Some of what is in HCR 2001 already is law in Arizona, like counting only ballots received by the close of polls on Election Day, and anybody casting a ballot in person has to provide identification. But the measure would also disallow early voting after 7 p.m. on the Friday before Election Day to keep people from dropping off their early ballots at polling places, thus delaying final election results. That require people who sign up for early voting to re-verify their address every 2 years. and it would outlaw all mail elections. They guarantee the right to vote in person on election day at conveniently located polling places, something that is not defined. Whatever the merits of the proposal, there is a political component. Cullinan is running for Secretary of State, and his anticipated foe is incumbent Democrat Adrian Fontes, who has openly opposed much of what is in the proposals. Fontes told Capital Media Services that what Cullinan wants is just more of what Republicans have pushed in the past and been unable to act because of the vetoes by Governor Katie Hobbs. And he said there are specific problems. If enacted, this legislation would make it harder to vote by mail and harder to vote generally, exactly the opposite direction of where we should be headed, he said. Fontes said eliminating some option for early voters to simply drop off their ballots also will result in longer lines at the polling places. And he predicted the provisions, if approved, would cause voter confusion and then lead to litigation. Still, Cullinan is not acting alone. Senator Shauna Bolick, Republican out of Phoenix, introduced a mirror proposal in the Senate, though she did not respond to multiple requests to discuss those provisions. What could prove to be the most controversial, at least legally, are those sections about citizenship proof to vote in all elections and to get a mail-in ballot. Voters passed a measure in 2004 mandating such proof. Looking at Law and Order at 21 past, a man found in a crashed car on Sunday was shot in a confrontation earlier at a house on the city's southeast side, Tucson police have said. At about 4:15 p.m., officers were on their way to a shooting call in the 1900 block of South Montezuma Avenue, where a car crash was reported nearby, Tucson police said in a news release. The crash happened in the 1900 block of East 31st Street near East 29th Street and South Alvernon Way. Officer found M. Israel Lopez, 19 years old, inside the vehicle. He had been shot. Lopez died later at the hospital. Police say Lopez was shot during a confrontation at the house on Montezuma, and investigators say witnesses reported that gunfire erupted during a confrontation between two men and occupants of the house. The house was empty, however, when police arrived, the release said. The shooting is still being investigated. A former U.S. border agent was sentenced in federal court to 6.5 years in prison for allowing drug loads, to get through the checkpoint on I-19 south of Tucson. U.S. District Judge Rosemary Marquez on October 30th sentenced Jorge J. Jimenez, 54 years, to 78 months of custody, federal prosecutors said. And an 86-year-old woman has died days after being injured in a crash in Midtown. About 12:30 p.m. on November 8th, Hawa Klein was a passenger in a Lexus sedan that was struck by a northbound Hyundai hatchback as it turned left from southbound Craycroft Road onto East Broadway. Investigators were notified on the 16th that Klein had died, the release said. Failing to yield oncoming traffic while making a left turn by the Lexus is a primary cause of the collision, the release said. And the investigation continues. Taking a look at Tim Steller's column, it's one thing to sell the name of Arizona Stadium. Yes, to many people around Tucson, that's a sacrilege. But having seen the financial condition of the University of Arizona and its athletics operation over the last few years, I can understand the need for a neat $3 million per year over the next 20 years. It's another thing, though, to sell those naming rights to a gambling business, Casino del Sol. Yes, it's a local firm run by the local tribe, and those are good things, but naming the stadium after a casino just reinforces tendencies in society that appear to be growing especially bad among students on the U of A campus. At the U of A, probably well over 50% of the male population engages in sports betting. As I spoke with more than a dozen male students on campus on Monday, they gave me rough estimates that they often range higher, especially in certain subcultures like the fraternities. Among those gambling students, there are some who get in deep. One student I spoke with on Frat Row Monday told me he's $10,000 in the hole. This is, of course, just a reflection of society as a whole, since the Supreme Court ruled in 2018 that states could legalize sports betting. Arizona legalized it in 2021 and capped its tax rate on the profits in 2022. In the first months of legalized sports betting, September 2021, Arizona gamblers placed $291 million in bets. 4 years later, in September 2025, the total of known sports bets in Arizona was $851 million. Subtract the $794 million in payouts this September, and you get a net of $55 million. After that, you subtract $35 million in free bets or promotional credits for a profit of $19.6 million. On that, Arizona took in privilege fees of $1.9 million, a pretty paltry sum on total bets approaching $1 billion, in my view. Of course, those figures represent just what's known and conducted through the 14 sportsbooks registered within the state. Those big online betting sites like FanDuel and DraftKings require proof that users are actually 21 years old. On campus, everyone knows the other sites, the ones that anyone can play, or ways to use the big apps despite being underage. With the big-time apps, you have to be 21 to do those, but there are so many other ways around it and so many loopholes, said Senior Ryan Lisa, the son of my long-ago Flagstaff roommate. Sitting outside the student union, freshman Tanner Gunn told me he and his two friends were used to it, but we quit. Why? The obvious reasons. I lost my money. I'm a broke college student. Sophomore Gray Sia told me he uses an account of a friend who is over 21 but says he stays in control. I wouldn't say it goes like more than $20. I like to keep it safe, he told me. But not everybody can do so. Among the dozen or so students I talked to, the word degenerate to describe friends with bad gambling habits came up more than once. There's definitely a lot of sports betting going on. I'm included in that, but my friends take it to another level, Lisa said. Explain that on a day with a lot of good games, he'll bet small amounts on games and parlays. For me, it's more of a lower range, he said. I've got people I know who bet $1,000 or $1,500. Gambling addictions have, of course, surged with the spread of sports betting, and the brains of the young, still developing, still around 25, are especially susceptible. And this is a nationwide issue, of course. In 2023, the NCAA had a survey done of 18 to 22-year-olds, found that 67% of those living on college campuses were bettors. The likelihood of engaging in betting activities, the amount wagered, and the amount lost increases as educational attainment level increases, although this could be attributable to other factors such as an increase in age. Now, Casino del Sol is not a big sports betting venue like the other Anlipes are. They have Soul Sports, a site at the casino where you can bet on sports, but they don't have online betting, which is now almost everybody gambles on sports these days. Still, I was surprised that when I asked students about the newly named stadium on Monday, two of the bettors mentioned having gone to Casino del Sol to gamble. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Taking a look at business, Americans will be allowed to contribute more of their money to 401k and similar retirement saving plans next year. The IRS said the maximum contribution that an individual can make in 2026 to a 401k, 403b, and most 457 plans will be $24,500. That's up from $23,500 this year. People ages 50 and over who have the option to make additional catch-up contributions to their 401k and similar plans will be able to contribute up to $8,000 next year, up from $7,500 this year. That means a 401k saver who's 50 or older will be able to contribute a maximum of $32,500 to their retirement plan annually, starting in 2026. Workers between the ages of 60 and 63 will be allowed catch-up retirement plan contributions of up to $11,250 annually, unchanged from this year. The IRS also raised the 2026 annual contribution limits on individual retirement arrangements, or IRAs, to $7,500, up from $7,000 this year. The IRA catch-up contribution limit will include an annual cost of living adjustment of $100, increasing it to $1,100 in 2026. The changes, among others announced by the IRS, make it easier for retirement savers who use these types of tax advantage plans to set aside more of their income toward building their nest egg. That's especially helpful to older workers who got started saving for retirement later in life and can benefit from higher contribution limits. From Seoul, South Korea, Samsung Electronics and other major South Korean companies have announced fresh domestic investment plans at a meeting with President Lee Jae-min, who hopes the moves will counter concerns that the firms would prioritize U.S. investments under a trade deal. Lee's meeting with business leaders came on Sunday, days after his government finalized a trade deal with the United States, in which Seoul pledged to invest $350 billion in U.S. industries in exchange for averting the Trump administration's highest tariffs. Samsung, who's a global leader in computer chips, said it will invest $310 billion over the next 5 years to expand its domestic operations, including building another production line at its Pyeongtaek manufacturing hub to meet surging global semiconductor demands fueled by artificial intelligence. From Omaha, Nebraska, new data from the Agriculture Department has created serious doubts about whether China really will buy millions of bushels of American soybeans like the Trump administration touted last month after a high-stakes meeting between Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping. The USDA report, released after the government reopened Friday, showed only two Chinese purchases of American soybeans since the summit in South Korea that totaled 332,000 metric tons. That's well short of the 12 million metric tons that Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins said China agreed to purchase by January, and nowhere near the 25 million metric tons she said it would buy from each of the next 3 years. American farmers hoped their biggest customer would resume buying their crops, but CoBank's Tanner Emke, who is the lead economist for grains and oilseed, said there isn't much incentive for China to buy from America right now because it has plenty of soybeans on hand that it bought from Brazil and other South American countries this year, and the remaining tariffs ensure the U.S. soybeans remain more expensive than Brazilian beans. We're still not even close to what has been advertised from the U.S. in terms of what the agreement would have been looking like, Emke said. Beijing had to confirm a detailed soybean purchase agreement, only that the two sides reached consensus on expanding trade in farm products. Emke said even if China did promise to buy American soybeans, it may have agreed to buy them only if the price was attractive. Trump said his team spoke with Chinese officials on Friday, and they assured the White House they would purchase more soybeans, but he didn't offer any details of how much. They're in the process of doing not only a little bit, but they'll be doing a lot of soybean purchases, he told reporters. The Chinese tariff on American beans remains high at about 24%, despite a 10-year percentage point reduction after the summit. It's 33 minutes past the hour. Looking at letters to the editor, Stephen Fleming, who lives in Midtown, writes that, "I live near the Sunshine Mile project on Broadway. I'm glad that developer Peter Andrinstadikas has outlined a path forward for developing the relocated bungalows that were on the north side of the street. It should become a unique and attractive set of restaurants and shops. But Tucson Gastro Park? I can't be the only one who sees gastro and mentally completes it as gastrointestinal. The park sounds like a bunch of doctor's offices ready to do unpleasant things with endoscopes and colonoscopes. Not appetizing at all." Again, Steve Fleming from Midtown. And Margaret Zanger from Midtown as well writes, "The long-term desert dweller says that unless they can somehow create the millions of gallons of water needed for their developments, both HUD-based Copper World and Amazon's Blue Project, Project Blue that is, need to be taken off the table immediately. Arizona agencies and politicians need to find backbones and just say no. There is simply not enough water to allow a Canadian company to suck up and then contaminate our aquifer for enormous profits. And I'm sure plenty of states with plenty of water would be happy to welcome in Project Blue. Tom McGorry from the Northwest side, even though large families are no longer in style, I believe there is a case for the larger family. My father John was the youngest of seven, and my grandfather Francis had eight children. My great-grandfather Daniel had 12, and I'm the middle child of seven. I had seven children. My wife Caroline is one of seven. Big families are often filled with love, laughter, and plenty of opportunities to grow and learn together. Large families are such a gift, offering an amazing environment to grow in faith and building lasting family bonds. The lessons learned in a big family are priceless. Life in a big family is a constant adventure. With a large family, you're never alone. And one of the benefits of large family living is learning to share. If you're part of or raising a large family, cherish those moments, even the messy ones. Use them as opportunities to grow in character, nurture faith, and teach your children the value of hard work, love, and service. Clay Berger from the Foothills writes, letter writer Craig Miller is correct that fewer of us remember JFK. Mr. Miller asserts that JFK was ruled 4F, but his father and the family doctor said he was unfit for service. Actually, Joe Kennedy pulled strings and got his son a direct commission. Trump was called up for induction, failed his physical, and was found to be unfit for service, and was ruled 4F. JFK was in charge of PT-109 and ran into a Japanese destroyer and sank on a cloudless night. General MacArthur wanted him court-martialed, but Joe Kennedy pulled strings and he was awarded a medal. And as for JFK's Pulitzer Prize, it is generally well known that the book was ghost-written. John Knight from the Northeast side, every driver in Tucson knows that speeding, red light running, tailgating, and reckless driving are the norm in our city. Wrecks, injuries, and fatalities are more common here than in most other cities. We all know this. It's pretty clear that the absence of police and red light cameras to enforce traffic laws is the underlying cause of these problems. Tim Steller wrote a thoughtful article about this, yet he barely mentioned law enforcement as a solution. I wrote to compliment him and oppose law enforcement as a solution. His friend's reply noted that more enforcement might be the best way to improve traffic safety, but there isn't any hope in there being enough additional officers anytime soon. Well, why not? We all see the problem. We all know how to fix it. Yet our political leaders refuse to fund increased police manpower. Their policies are killing innocent people every day. How do they sleep? Time for new leadership? Louise Nath from Benson, RE, last Thursday's edition, you posted a picture of protesters at a Jim Click dealership. This may be a form of free speech to these folks, but what about Jim Click's freedom to choose whomever he wishes to support? This goes for anybody who supports a candidate of their choosing. I saw this same bunch of hypocrites on Saturday morning at the dealership, albeit on a sidewalk, near a sidewalk on the corner. I have a question for the protesters. Is Jim Cook using your money to support the candidates of his choice? Does anyone yell or protest to tell you how and where to spend your money? And Donna Hill from Saddlebrook. I'm just wondering if anybody else is outraged by the fact that the real criminals, those convicted of serious crimes but are useful to Trump, receive pardons while brown people get rounded up and brutalized by ICE. According to these daily news reports, many of these people are law-abiding citizens and are living here legally. It shouldn't be a crime to be brown or black in this country. And people convicted of serious crimes should be jailed and remain behind bars and not pardoned. Just my humble opinion. Again, Donna Hill from Saddlebrook. Onward to national world news. Here's the digest. From San Francisco, Meta prevailed over an existential challenge to its business that would have forced the tech giant to spin off Instagram and WhatsApp after a judge ruled the company does not hold a monopoly in social networking. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg issued his ruling on Tuesday after the antitrust trial wrapped up in late May. The Federal Trade Commission continues to insist that Meta competes with the same old rivals that it has for the last decade, that the company holds a monopoly among that small set, and that it maintained that monopoly through anti-competitive acquisitions, he wrote. Whether or not Meta enjoyed monopoly power in the past, though, The agency must show that it continues to hold such power now. The court's verdicts today determine that the FTC has not done so. From Washington, National Public Radio will receive about $36 million in grant money to operate the nation's public radio interconnection system under the terms of a court settlement with the federal government steward of funding for public broadcasting stations. The settlement, announced late on Monday, partially resolves a legal dispute in which NPR accused the Corporation for Public Broadcasting of bowing to pressure from Trump to cut off its funding. On April 2nd, CBP's board approved a three-year extension of a grant for NPR to operate the satellite system for public radio, but CBP officials later reversed course. NPR accused the CPB of violating its First Amendment free speech rights when it moved to cut off its access to grant money appropriated by Congress. NPR also claims that Trump, a Republican, wants to punish it for the content of its journalism. 10 Democratic secretaries of state asked the Trump administration on Tuesday to provide more information about its efforts to seek statewide voter registration lists, citing concerns that federal agencies might be entering the data in a program used to verify U.S. citizenship. The U.S. Department of Energy said on Tuesday that it will loan about $1 billion to help finance the restart of the nuclear power plant on Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island, site of a nuclear accident in 1979, that is under contract to supply power to data centers for Microsoft. From the Mideast, Palestinians stabbed an Israeli to death and wounded three more on Tuesday in the West Bank before being shot down by troops, the Israeli military have said. An Israeli airstrike killed 13 people, wounded several others at a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon, state media and the Lebanese Health Ministry have reported. From New Orleans, federal border agents will descend on New Orleans in the coming weeks for Swamp Sweep, a two-month immigration crackdown, according to documents and three people familiar with the operation. From North Carolina, federal agents expanded their North Carolina immigration crackdown on Tuesday to the area around the state capital, Raleigh. And from Mexico, President Claudia Sheinbaum ruled out allowing U.S. strikes against cartels on Mexican soil on Tuesday, a day after United States President Trump said he was willing to do whatever it takes to stop drugs from entering the United States. And from the Associated Press, members of the Sackler family who own OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma must pay millions of dollars to settle a flood of lawsuits over the harms of opioids after a federal bankruptcy judge formally approved a new deal on Tuesday. The Sacklers must contribute up to $7 billion over 15 years. Most of the money will go to government entities to fight the opioid crisis, which is linked to 900,000 deaths in the United States since 1999. Thousands of victims could be paid thousands of dollars each, with some distributions beginning next year for people who had OxyContin prescriptions and their survivors. From Washington, Trump on Tuesday dismissed U.S. intelligence findings that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman likely had some culpability in the 2018 killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, as Trump warmly welcomed the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia on his first White House visit in 7 years. The U.S.-Saudi relationship was for a time in a tailspin after the operation targeting Khashoggi, a first critic of the kingdom. 7 years later, Trump tightened his embrace of the 40-year-old crown prince, who said he is an indispensable player in shaping the Middle East in the decades to come. Prince Mohammed denies involvement in the killing of Khashoggi, who was a Saudi citizen and a Virginia resident. Whether you like him or you don't like him, things happen, Trump said of the international incident when asked by a reporter, but he knew nothing about it, and we can leave it at that. You don't have to embarrass our guest by asking a question like that. U.S. intelligence officials determined the Saudi crown prince likely approved Saudi's agents' killing of the U.S.-based journalist inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, according to U.S. findings declassified in 2021 at the start of the Biden administration. Trump officials refused to release this report during his first administration. The Crown Prince announced Saudi Arabia will increase its planned investments in the United States to $1 trillion. And that's up from $600 billion that the Saudis say they plan to invest in May. Trump's family has a strong personal interest in the kingdom. In September, London real estate developer Dar Global announced that they had plans to launch Trump Plaza in the Red Sea city of Jeddah. In addition to White House pomp, two nations also planned an investment summit at the Kennedy Center today that will include the heads of Salesforce, Qualcomm, Pfizer, the Cleveland Clinic, Chevron, and Aramco, Saudi Arabia's national oil and natural gas company. And ahead of Prince Mohammed's arrival, Trump announced he agreed to sell the Saudis' F-35 fighter jets despite some concerns within the administration that the sale could lead to China gaining access to U.S. technology behind the advanced plans. Again from Washington, the United States Education Department said on Tuesday it'll hand off some of its biggest grant programs to other federal agencies as the Trump administration accelerates its plan to shut down the department. It represents a major step forward for the administration's dismantling of the department, which mainly involved cutting jobs since Trump called for its elimination with an executive action in March. Six new agreements signed by the Education Department will effectively move billions of dollars in grant programs to other agencies. Most notable is one that will put the Department of Labor over some of the largest federal funding streams for K-12 schools, including Title I money for schools serving low-income communities. Opponents say such a shakeup could disrupt programs that would support some of the nation's most vulnerable student populations. A union representing department workers said that students, educators, and families depend on the agency's support for schools, and department officials said the programs will continue to be funded at levels that are set by Congress. A federal court blocked Texas on Tuesday from using a redrawn U.S. House map that touched off a nationwide redistricting battle and is a major piece of Trump's efforts to preserve a slim Republican majority ahead of the 2026 elections. The ruling is a blow to Trump's rush to create a more favorable political landscape for Republicans in next year's midterms, at least for now. Texas Governor Greg Abbott filed a swift appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court and defended the map that was engineered to give Republicans five additional House seats. In a 2-1 ruling, a panel of federal judges in El Paso sided with opponents who argued that Texas's unusual summer redrawing of congressional districts would harm Black and Hispanic residents. The decision was authored by U.S. District Judge Jeffrey V. Brown, who was nominated to the bench by Trump during his first term. The public perception of this case is that it's about politics. To be sure, politics played a role in the drawing of the 2025 map, but it was much more than just politics. Substantial evidence shows that Texas racially gerrymandered the 2025 map, the ruling states. The decision comes amid a widening national battle over redistricting. Missouri and North Carolina followed Texas with new maps, adding an additional Republican seat each. To counter these moves, California voters approved a ballot initiative to give Democrats five more seats there. The Trump administration filed a lawsuit hoping to block that map. In a post on social media, California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom celebrated the Texas ruling. Quote, Donald Trump and Greg Abbott played with fire, got burned, and democracy won, end quote. Republicans in Texas claim they drew the new map only for partisan advantage. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2019 that partisan gerrymandering is a political question and not one for the federal courts to decide. The legislature redrew our congressional maps to better reflect Texans' conservative voting preferences, and for no other reason, Abbott said. A coalition of civil rights groups representing Black and Hispanic voters argued that the map reduced the influence of minority voters, making it a racially gerrymander that violates the Federal Voting Rights Act and the United States Constitution. Texas filed its appeal on Tuesday evening with the U.S. Supreme Court, and if the ruling stands, Texas will be forced to use the map drawn by the GOP-controlled legislature in 2021 for next year's elections. It's 10 minutes in front of 1 o'clock. Taking a look at sports, the Detroit Lions' fistful of fourth down failures may have doomed them to a crucial loss at Philadelphia, but it was field judge Lo Van Pham's dubious pass interference call in the waning minutes that sealed the Eagles' triumph and jumbled the NFC playoff picture. What appeared to be like a textbook stop on third down by the Lions to force a punt instead turned into a new set of downs for the Eagles and sparked online and on-air backlash. Referee Alex Kemp explained to a pool reporter after the Eagles' 16-9 win that Pham saw Lions cornerback Rock Ya-Sin grab Eagles receiver A.J. Brown by the arm, preventing him from going up to make a catch on a high pass from Jalen Hurts on 3rd and 8 from the Philadelphia 37 with just under 2 minutes remaining. And Pham might be the only one who saw it that way. The Lions thought they'd gotten the stop, forcing a punt with 1:47 remaining to give Jared Goff a chance to drive the Lions to the tying touchdown. Instead, the Eagles had first down on their 45-yard line with a new set of downs. The Lions never got the ball again. With the loss, the Lions fell to 6-4 into third place in the NFC behind Chicago and Green Bay, and more importantly, they tumbled completely out of the NFC playoff picture, falling 5 spots into 8th place with 7 weeks remaining. At 8-2, the Eagles soared to the top of the NFC playoff race, fueled by a stingy defense that time and again makes up for a sputtering offense, just like the Broncos, who sit atop the AFC playoff race at 9-2. Even NBC color commentator Chris Collinsworth was dumbfounded by the defensive pass interference call, labeling the penalty absolutely terrible on the game's Sunday Night Football broadcast. Oh, come on, come on, a perplexed Collinsworth hollered as the replay was shown. That's terrible. That is an absolutely terrible call that's going to decide this football game. As the play was shown again, Collinsworth added, if anything, it's an offensive push. Ya-Sin looked as shocked as Collinsworth that the foul was on him and not on Brown for pushing off. That's an offensive foul, Collinsworth said. If you want to call a foul, that's an offensive foul. Wow. Play-by-play announcer Mike Tirico chimed in, saying there was certainly hand fighting, but not even at the level we've seen all night. It certainly didn't seem like the routine hand fighting that happens on just about every pass play rose to the level of defensive pass interference. And that game-deciding flag put an emphatic exclamation point on Week 11, which featured 5 last-second field goals that decided games, a 6th one missed at the gun, and several other questionable calls, but none were as significant as the one against the Lions. The Lions have already lost twice as many games as they did last year, when they went 15-2 and earned the franchise's first-ever #1 playing seed. I really feel like we have not played our best ball yet collectively, all 3 units, Coach Dan Campbell said as he looked ahead to Detroit's Week 12 matchup with the Giants. Once we get there, I believe there will be no looking back. And in NCAA basketball, there's a game today. It's #4 Arizona. We're 4-0 at #3 UConn. They're also at 4-0. Happens at 5 p.m. tonight at the Harry A. Gamble Pavilion in Storrs, Connecticut. You can watch it on television on Fox Sports 1 and listen to it on 1290 AM and 107.5 FM. And after winning his second straight national championship at State Farm Stadium in April of 2024, and then complaining about the 24/7 nature of college basketball's transfer portal, going 0-3 in the Maui Invitational a year ago, and bouncing from the NCAA tournament's second round last March, UConn coach Dan Hurley considered retiring at the age of 52. I was completely cooked, he wrote in his recent release book, Never Stop, Life, Leadership, and What It Takes to Be Great. But while he's since recommitted to the idea of being a college coach for the long haul, Hurley jokingly reconsidered that thought Saturday night after UConn's 20-point second half nearly melted away in an 86-84 win over BYU in a top-10 matchup. The Huskies had enjoyed playing a predominantly pro-Huskies crowd at Boston's TD Garden, could have even more vocal support when Arizona wanders into UConn's Gamble Pavilion tonight, but that's only a first of 2 games that the teams have agreed to play. The second one is scheduled to be played at McHale Center on November 18th next year, and the chances are Dan has heard a few things about Bobby about the plays. I'm glad to be having them here this year, Hurley told the Arizona Daily Star after the BYU game, because I know that Hurley's treatment in Tucson is, well, maybe I'll just coach this year and actually do the retirement so I don't have to go to Tucson. That might be tempting, but this sort of series is also just what Dan Hurley appears to want. Under Hurley, who's in his eighth season with the Huskies, arrived a year after UConn last appeared in Tucson, UConn has annually woven in a significant number of high-caliber teams into its non-league schedule. The Huskies had Indiana, Texas, Kansas, North Carolina, and Gonzaga in the 2023-24 season, and then the Maui games, plus Texas, Baylor, and Gonzaga last season. And now Arizona, too, mixed in this season with the UConn schedule. That includes BYU, Illinois, Kansas, Florida, and Texas. I'm going to give credit to our general manager, Tom Moore, for contracting the U of A series, Hurley said. I'm real bad with the phone. The staffs kind of reach out and say, hey, do you guys want to do this? Well, that would be fun. Should be fun for Hurley, for his players, for the UConn fans, and everybody watching the FS1 broadcast. It could be a lot of fun for Arizona, too, if the Cats pull off another November upset, the kind they are becoming known for under fifth-year coach Tommy Lloyd. But the Cats have little to lose if they don't. The game will be Arizona's first top-five matchup since the top-ranked Wildcats faced number 3 Purdue in December of 2023, before the Boilermakers went on to face Hurley's Huskies in Glendale during the national championship game. It's also Arizona's first time facing back-to-back ranked teams outside of conference play since the Cats beat Wisconsin at home and then suffered their first loss of the 23-24 season in that Purdue game. And for this tough two-game stretch, the Wildcats opened by beating number 15 UCLA 69-65 last Friday in Los Angeles, then returned home for 2 days of prep and traveled to Connecticut on Monday afternoon. We can't relax, said U of A assistant coach Ken Nakagawa, who has been scouting the Huskies. We're treating this like a second game in the NCAA tournament, second weekend, like an Elite Eight game. So after playing a team like UCLA, you're going to play another high-caliber team. It's a great test to see how we can manage that. The same applies for UConn, which also beat a national-ranked opponent by a smaller margin in its previous game, but in an even scarier fashion after Boston area product A.G. Dimpasa of BYU led a late Cougar rally. It's a weird feeling because you had a chance to really put on a 40-minute great performance, but it's early in the year, Hurley said after the game. Teams improve throughout the year, and maybe over the course of the next couple of weeks you're able to sustain 30 minutes at that level, and then 33 minutes at that level, and then 37 at that level. But it was a big win for us, and it obviously creates an even bigger game tonight. Thank you for listening. Mark DeGroft with you. Stay tuned to more Sun Sounds programming. Have yourself a wonderful rest of your day.